On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys! It's happening! Oh, my God, guys! Oh, my God! I wish you all were here!
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No!
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
And in a couple of days, we'll see a slight tweak. I'll panic about it and repeat the cycle again and again for the next couple months.
I'm not sure what the f*** this is. I'm about to find out.
This is Tall Can Audio.
What's happening, everybody? Welcome into an all-new episode of the Tall Can Audio podcast. It's Matt Robinson here with you in our beautiful Bytown, Canada studios. Our studio in beautiful Bytown, Canada, however you want to look at that. No one will know. No one else is in here. It's pandemic times. Joining me today from the faceoffcircle.ca, it's Jeff Payette. How are you doing today, man?
Fantastic. Happy to be back.
For those who remember, who've been around long enough, Jeff was one of the first people we reached out to when we entered the land of pandemia back in the spring. And he was good enough to come on and talk a little Leafs with us. But at that time, we had no idea what was coming and whether we were going to get bubble hockey, what laid ahead. I certainly don't think either of us expected we would still be, the numbers keep skyrocketing. We don't need to get too far into that. But what have you been keeping yourself busy with through this craziest of years?
Just kind of figuring out my own life. Like, it's a good opportunity with hockey off the table to decide your priorities, decide what you want to kind of do next. So just kind of getting myself in a good mindset, and now I'm excited to take that into this season, get back to writing full time, which I haven't really done to the same extent in the last couple years. Going back to that kind of daily beat sort of thing seems like it's going to be a fun experience, even though it'll mostly be from home. But, I can't wait.
One of the things that normally happens, and there's been nothing normal about anything that's happened lately. But before the pandemic, when we would have guests in studio with us, we would sit down and we would have a craft beer or two with them while we talked about or whatever we were going to talk about that day. And as the spring kind of rolled on, my listeners started to get on me about how I was talking to the guests and said, just because they can't be in studio doesn't mean you shouldn't be asking them about their craft beer take. So I will take this opportunity because I didn't do it back in April. Are you much of a craft beer guy at all? Is that your scene at all?
See, I'm kind of boring when it comes to that stuff. I'm usually just like whatever's available.
Sure.
I will say during the start of the pandemic, it was nice to have Amsterdam down.
Yes.
Down on Bathurst, who was doing the delivery when the LCBO and beer store were still figuring their stuff out. I haven't been drinking as much lately, though. It's kind of trying to keep it clean, kind of keep it relaxed. So, there's a lot of places here in Toronto that are in that little industry. And whenever I'm out with friends, we tend to taste around. But I'm not like someone who's in depth with their preferences, just very open minded.
You got anything out of Amsterdam that you can remember off the top of your head that you really like of theirs?
Even just their blonde or three speed, like you can stick with the classics.
Sure.
I'm not not overly picky.
One of my favorites out of Toronto is their Downtown Brown is one I really like. But I'm sure not actually named after, but I always associated with our boy Connor Brown, and now he's up here in Ottawa. But I still love him, right? You can't hold his new jersey against him. Before we get too in depth with Jeff here, want to remind everybody that we are going to get the other side of the coin on the show in terms of the Battle of Ontario. Graham Nichols, the Sixth Sens, will be on Thursday morning to talk about the Senators and what this season's going to look like for them. So encourage you to stick around for that one as well. We are on Twitter and Instagram at TallCanAudio, Facebook.com/TallCanAudio. I hope you'll subscribe wherever you're listening to this one. A bunch of things here as it pertains to the Leafs that we could start with, Jeff, but why don't we just kind of before we kind of drill down on anything, we did get a chance to see the team on Saturday night. It was, you know, the blue and white game broadcast across the province. God love the Leafs. From this internal scrimmage, did anything stand out to you that maybe you weren't expecting, or somebody looked better or worse, or something that caught you off guard?
I mean, firstly, it was really cool that they did that whole experience. I think it gave fans a chance to kind of get back into the groove. It gave game operations a chance to warm up. It gave some of the players a little bit of experience. So that first off was pretty great. Just in terms of like little things, like I was very impressed by how all the big four seemed to be ready and engaged. I swear Mitch Marner must have taken like 30 shots in that game.
Honestly,
Tavares showed his strength with his goal. Matthews is Matthews. Nylander is Nylander. Beyond that, you saw guys like Mikko Lehtonen making plays that show a little bit of that comfort zone here. I think that's a good sign in terms of how he's going to adapt later in the year. Guys like Travis Boyd, who want to make sure that they're sticking with the taxi squad. He was working very, really, really hard out there. I was actually pretty pleasantly surprised by that. Mm-hmm. It was a little let down, like Sheldon Keefe had mentioned about Pierre Engvall's play. He did have that one breakaway goal, but there wasn't there weren't that many great puck decisions on his point. And I think generally it was a really wide open game.
Yeah.
A lot of stretch passes, a lot of cherry picking. I mean, these guys haven't played in an actual game situation in like 6 months, so hard to blame them. But it was nice to kind of get some sort of realistic reps for them with there not being exhibition games going into this season. Like, that's as close as they're going to get.
Yeah.
And for a lot of teams, just doing that kind of one-off is as close as they're going to get. So for them to try to make it as authentic as possible, I thought was a really nice touch.
What did you think? You mentioned two names there. Both of them are names I'm intrigued by. Why don't we start with Pierre Engvall? Because to me, he's an interesting guy, and I want to get your take on this. The people that I follow on Twitter seem to be more analytically minded than myself, and I like that. It's kind of brought me along, right, in terms of how to look at some of these things. But he's an interesting guy, and when he was called up last year, he got a really hot start, and I think he scored shorthanded maybe in his first NHL game, and he was pretty good there to start. And then it kind of dragged a little bit after that, and they didn't necessarily seem to have a great role for him, and he bounced around and maybe wasn't all that good in the bubble. I've sort of been of this mindset that he had a hot start and then kind of this drag of a finish. Why does everyone seem to want to associate him more that hot start is really him and the lesser lights later on in the season aren't, when we kind of, you know, the sample size is so small on both? Did you expect more from him, or is there something I'm missing about him that maybe he should have been on the roster? Kind of, what are your thoughts on him right now?
I mean, I expected more of him than what we've seen in this recent stretch. I don't know if his start was reflective of the level of player that he is. That was a little bit of a surprise.
He kind of raised the bar a little bit for himself.
Exactly. But at the same time, like, I think going into last year, he was really high on my call-up list. I think I had him like first or second.
Okay.
He's been a guy that, especially under Keefe, he's used for several years now. He was the shutdown left winger on the 2018 Calder Cup team. Mm-hmm. He's obviously got this incredible skating ability, probably the fastest guy on the roster. Even last year, I know everyone was hyped on now Pittsburgh Penguin Kasperi Kapanen's speed, but I think Engvall, even though his strides weren't as quick because of his size, he was able to keep up at just about the same rate. And that shows up in things like his transition stats. Like, his zone entry rates were very good, his exit rates were very good, but he hasn't been making great puck decisions in the last little while. The areas where he's best in seem to be the ones where his tools are able to kind of replace his brain. So like the penalty kill, he's really strong on. Mm-hmm. The team generates a lot of counterattack when he's on the ice. He limits quite a bit of attack when he's on as well. That's because the penalty kill is pretty simple. Being a great penalty killer doesn't necessarily mean you're good defensively. There's a very few set group of plays that you do. You kind of stick to a system, and if you have the talent to go and do something once you have the puck, then that does something for you.
Sure.
So that's an area where he was able to stand out very quickly, but it doesn't necessarily show a form of growth that just kind of shows what kind of player he is built as. Mm-hmm. And as a 6'5" fast skating player, you're always going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Where he kind of almost screws himself over is his contract. And that's kind of weird when you kind of consider that he's not making a heck of a lot of money.
Right.
But it's just enough that it makes it hard to put him into a depth position. He banks just over the variable limit at $1.25 million, which means even as they send him down, he's still going to carry about $100,000 cap hit.
Right.
And in a lot of respects, it's more favorable to them to have a player that's making the league minimum. They can't really, they can't have the same patience in terms of growing pains and early season mistakes. So for him, he has to go up against someone who's making $850,000 or less, because as long as he's sent down, that's the equivalent.
Right.
And when you have guys like Jason Spezza, Joe Thornton, who kind of fit into that, Travis Boyd, Nick Petan, Alex Barabanov, all these guys fit in that range. He's kind of stuck right at the middle where if he hits and he's hot, then yeah, the contract looks really good. But when you're a team that's going stars and scrubs, where you have your top guys making a ton of money and your little guys making really close to the minimum, you kind of can't be that in-between guy and get that opportunity, the opportunities to keep proving yourself at the NHL level. The good news for him is because he's waiver exempt for 1 year, he is able to go straight down to the Marlies, and that gives him an opportunity to regrow his game when their season picks up. I think in about 3-4 weeks from now, they start their process of coming back. And when he was down there last time, he was close to a point a game player. He was playing heavy, even strength. He was playing power play and penalty kill. It gave him an opportunity to grow a little bit. And we'll see if he can do the same thing with Greg Moore that he did with Sheldon Keefe. But that's what he's going to have to do now. At 24 years old, he doesn't really have a lot of time to evolve his game that much. But when it comes to having brains, this is a high IQ team. This is the way they play. It's all about being in good positions and making the right plays and being part of set plays. And he needs to figure that out to find success at this level.
What do you think, just kind of as we wrap on him, the idea that, to me, if he was going to make the team, it was kind of going to be in this fourth line role, maybe to be a penalty killer, which he, as you've mentioned, he is pretty good at. And instead, they go with Alex Barabanov, who's kind of the mystery box right now in terms of what he might be in the NHL. But they do seem to have this loyalty would be overstating it, but this feeling that if we bring you over from the KHL, we're going to give you a real shot at this, whether it was Ozaganov or Mikheyev or some of these Zaitsev. If you come over, if you sign here, we're going to play you. Do you think he has fallen victim to just a commitment that Barabanov was going to get a shot first? Because to me, he's the one sitting in Engvall's spot if Engvall was going to make it.
No, I don't think that that's the situation at all. In fact, I've spoken to a couple people on where this kind of evens out, and Barabanov is not in that specific equation. Barabanov's equation is with Mikko Lehtinen. They're the two who can kind of bounce in and out between the lineup and the taxi squad, both as European UFAs, both with that waiver exempt status, which means they can go between the taxi squad and the main roster on a consistent basis. This wasn't something where it was going to be those two.
Okay.
The person who is benefiting from this, in my eyes, is Adam Brooks. Adam Brooks was supposed to be the Marlies' number one center to start the year, as he's been given opportunities to in the last couple of years. Injuries have kind of gotten in the way of that, but when he's played, he's had that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
He was not expected to make the Leafs out of camp. He did go through the waiver process at the same time as everybody else the other day, but he was not assigned.
Right.
He is still with the team. He will start most likely with the taxi squad. So for me, Engvall is independent of this. Brooks, if anything, is a benefactor of Engvall not having the start that he wanted to. But this was a case where Engvall was in the driver's seat. He had the opportunity to at least be a taxi squad player. I even thought a couple of weeks ago before camp started, he was a lock to be at least a taxi squad guy, mm-hmm. maybe go down a little bit. But this is a missed opportunity on his end. And on the opposite end, you have a guy like Brooks who doesn't necessarily have those qualitative tools. He's a smaller guy. He's not a huge hitter or anything like that, but he's incredibly smart and he's willing to work hard. He's always engaged. He works on the cycle. He knows how to make plays. He knows how to find open passes. And he's in the same kind of situation in terms of age where this is going to be a make or break season,
right,
for his growth. So he's worked for his opportunity and he's bought in. And he's kind of getting rewarded for that. While Engvall is in a situation now where he has to kind of regain that trust from a coaching staff who believed in him for years prior, which is what kind of makes that so interesting and makes that message so legitimate. It's not a guy who is not being given the benefit of the doubt or having it handed to him by someone who never believed in him. Right. It's a player who was believed in by this coaching staff, having to reassess. And another player who also has that similar kind of value getting his opportunity.
Yeah, and Keith was not shy about kind of saying in the press conference afterwards he had expected more out of Engvall. So the other guy, before we get to some of the big names here, coming out of that that scrimmage that you referenced was Mikko Lehtinen. It looks like he will start as the odd man out on defense. He had seen a lot of reps at camp and in this scrimmage. On the third pair left side. Now Dermott has moved back up and onto that. What do you make of that? And do you think it's just kind of a question of him needing more time, or are there some doubts there? What do you kind of make of what you've seen and what maybe the coaching staff has seen of him so far?
It's not something I would stress out too much. Like I had mentioned in the previous point, he's a guy that they don't expect to be playing every single game to start this season. Right. It's possible he kind of grows into it over time, but at the same time, he's a player who's played on European / international ice for the past who knows how many years at this point,
yeah,
pretty much his entire career. And there is a difference there. It's not as fast paced of a game. You have more time to make decisions. And when you're talking about an offensively minded player, you do need to make that adaption over time. And in Toronto's case, they have so many guys that they can kind of plug and play with at the bottom of the lineup that they can make these decisions.
Right.
And this is something that when Keith had an expanded roster, if the Marlies, the AHL gives you more players on your active roster at once than the NHL does. When you had these bunches of games where you're playing 3-3, which I don't believe the schedule does, but it's pretty close.
Yep.
You have those like 3-4s. 4-5s, that sort of thing. You need guys in and out, especially when you look at defense. Those guys are playing more minutes than the forwards are just by virtue of there being fewer of them. You're going to wear players out over the course of the year. So there's going to be opportunities for guys to come in and out, be it a Lehtinen or a Dermott or a Zach Bogosian. These are not going to be players who are playing all 56 games.
Right.
And that's okay. If anything, that's a strong positive to have, that you're comfortable with your 4-8 rather than just having to have a 5-6, or rather a 5-8, my mistake. Sure. For me, that's a flexibility thing. Obviously, the organization has believed in Dermott for quite some time. He's a player who's been leaned on at the AHL level, the NHL level. They really want to experiment with him to see what side how comfortable he is on each side. And there could be potential for him down the line to possibly hop into a top four role. I look at the expansion draft that's coming up this year and how it's pretty likely that that's going to come down to letting either Dermott or Justin Hall be exposed. One of them most likely getting claimed and the other one fitting into that role next to Jake Muzzin on the shutdown pair. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be Dermott's kind of opportunity to prove himself in that regard. He just needs to grasp it. So I think he's going to get the benefit of the doubt to start. Lehtinen gets his time to get a little bit more acclimated with the organization and with the style of play. And in a couple of days, we'll see a slight tweak. I'll panic about it and repeat the cycle again and again for the next couple months.
When you watched Lehtinen in that scrimmage, you mentioned some really nice plays offensively, a couple of really nice breakout passes. And
shootout goal.
Yeah, exactly. And looked like, you know, reasonably comfortable working a power play. The concern seemed to be, you know, that things, as you referenced, happen faster in his own end, right? And maybe he wasn't quite used to how fast things were happening around him there, and whether or not defensively he was used to some of the strength and stuff that he was going up against. Did you see much of that? And do you think that's something that he can get acclimated to with more practicing, or at some point are they going to have to throw him to the wolves and see if he can do this in his own end?
I think it's a bit of both. I'm not going to read too much into what was seen in that that one game. But there's going to be an element of that. It's going to be heavy practices. He's going to be a guy who's going to have a lot more reps in those situations than a player of his minute stature normally would. And again, I really do think he'll be in the lineup quick enough. The third pair is going to be very, very fluid this year. I'm dead certain of that. There's no reason whatsoever to feel comfortable guaranteeing which two guys are playing on that pair in the lineup, even on a day-by-day basis. Just knowing how Keith has rolled out defensemen when he's had this opportunity to pick from 7-8 guys before. And it might even come down to the style of play when you're facing a team that's heavier, more about displacement and cycling. It might be a Bogosian. When you're facing a team that has a weak penalty kill, it might be.
I was just going to say, what do you think about strength of opponent, right? Because in the first weekend, the Leafs play Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. You know, maybe you just see Sandin gets in on Friday and Lettinen gets in on Saturday. Like, there's a back-to-back there. It's 3-4. It's a weaker opponent in the second two of those three. You know, maybe you start working guys in right away. Let's see.
Absolutely. I don't necessarily think it's strength of opponent so much as style of opponent, especially looking at this division. Really, like, between there's Toronto is the likely favorites to win the division. Mm-hmm. There's Ottawa is the likely team to finish at the bottom, and then everyone else in the middle where there's no clue. And even that first and seventh is no guarantee either. Right. It's going to come down to how the teams play, who favors net front, who has a dump and chase, who cycles more, that sort of thing. And even just how guys are feeling. You don't want someone who's kind of limping around after a rough night playing if someone who's almost equal to them in talent is available. And that's going to be the case. Even at the bottom, even the guys who got sent down, like, you have players like Callie Rose and Martin Marincin who you don't necessarily want playing in your lineup every night, but they could be called up if the situation required it. Rosen's a little bit less likely just because he plays a similar style to Lettinen. There's no need to kind of double up on that.
Yeah.
On that, but the point kind of remains is there's going to be a lot of flexible opportunity for this to happen. And in a lot of cases, it's going to come down to how guys are playing too. I wouldn't have necessarily had Sandin making the opening night roster because of his ability to go straight down to the Marlies. That would have given them a lot more flexibility to just send him straight down. But clearly, through his scrimmage, through his camp, he kind of worked himself into that. Maybe Timothy Liljegren goes on a good run of the Marlies and gets himself back up into the lineup. This is going to be the beauty of this part of the lineup is there's just so much to work with, and the rules are so much in favor of experimentation this year.
Well, let's work our way up in the lineup a little bit. When Joe Thornton was signed, I don't know about you, but I did not envision that he would be starting the season on the top line. I thought there was some flexibility in terms of where he might go. But I didn't see this. What were your kind of thoughts when you saw that was going to be the approach, at least to start the season? And are you in favor of it?
Well, firstly, I'm really excited that Joe Thornton's finally here.
It's awesome.
This was a multi-year pitch to him. They started on this right around the same summer as they signed Patrick Marleau. Mm-hmm. They went after both of them. Marleau said yes. Jumbo said, we'll wait and see. The next summer, we'll wait and see.
Yep.
Next summer, we'll wait and see. Next summer, hold on, I'm kind of off in the mountains in Switzerland, and so is my brother.
Britney
give me
Spears,
give us a few days to end our pilgrimage. No, and this is like pretty much what happened.
Yeah.
This is why it took a few days after Gate 1 is because they were off doing their own thing and not stressed. Like when he says I'm a no stress guy, there's really no kidding there.
Right.
So for him to finally be on board, it kind of shows you, one, that the San Jose window seems to be closed, but two, that he kind of sees something here. Mm-hmm. And to be able to do it at this price, like, is awesome.
Yeah.
As far as the spot in the lineup, I had heard a little bit about it a couple of weeks beforehand, how it was a thought. And it really is interesting. I don't know if it's the optimal line. I don't think it's not easy to figure out these combos until they're they're drawn up in and executed for the first time. But there are reasons to kind of believe in it. I'm a big believer in having someone who can strip the puck, having someone who can put in the net, and someone who can set it up. Right. One of each on a line, almost like Nintendo hockey, ice hockey, fat, skinny, medium kind of thing. Yes. Jumbo doesn't necessarily fit that. Generally, you're fat. There would be more like a Zach Hyman type. But we're talking about a guy who's very good at moving the puck around. He's very good at stripping the puck. I pointed out in a tweet to someone yesterday that all three of those players, Thornton, Matthews, and Marner, are in the 95th to 99th percentile in takeaways per hour in the league, which is that's silly. That means they're all elite at stripping the puck. And they'll turn it over a little bit too, but that's just virtue of having it. They're all in kind of that always has it on their stick or is about to move it sort of sense. And that's another thing that Thornton has to his advantage too, is he's not the same type of playmaker as Marner is. Like, we kind of look at playmakers as playmakers, but just like there are different types of scorers, different types of hitters, different types of tough guys, there are different types of playmakers. When you look at a guy like Marner, he carries the puck for a while. He skates around. He looks for a direct play. A Marner sequence is not one where he is actively passing back and forth with guys looking for the opportunity. He wants to control the play, and he basically just wants you to get to the place to score. And he's one of the best at doing it, but there are pros and cons to that style overall. On the flip side, you have a guy like Thornton, who kind of does things in a way similar to playmakers on the team like John Tavares, William Nylander, who will pass the puck back and forth. They will constantly look for spots, get into the next position. And because Joe Thornton is Joe Thornton, probably the second best playmaker in the history of the game, best outside of Gretzky, he can still do this at this age. He was in the 95th percentile in shot assists at 41 years old last year.
Right.
And that's a shot assist, for those who aren't into like the micro statistics. It's a stat track by Corey Snyder, shutdown line, where basically you're setting up a shot to kind of balance out shots that might not necessarily lead to goals.
Right.
The point of this is that he's still creating opportunities for players at a very elite level, and he does it in a way that's different to what Marner is. So that gives Matthew someone to link up back and forth with. It gives Marner an opportunity to kind of play finisher at times, because as we saw him trying in the blue and white game, this is a player who does want to try to score every so often. And when he was in junior, he was able to score, not at the absolute upper echelon, but enough to be a threat in his own regard.
Right.
We are still talking about a superstar offensive player, and he shouldn't be pigeonholed as just the pass first guy. Jumbo gives that opportunity to him. So there are a lot of reasons to kind of like what's going on there. And it allows for different parts of the lineup to be spread around. It allows for a Zach Hyman to kind of drop back and be the more physical presence on a line of puck retrievers, defensive guys that currently exist with Alex Kerfoot when he comes back from injury, and Ilya Mikheyev. Those two guys are also defensively strong, but they're not as physical.
Right.
So there's a value in moving him down too. It creates different opportunities for different sorts of roles to be played throughout the lineup. And that's what I find interesting.
Yeah, I think that's true, right? Like if Tavares and Nylander can carry VC, and VC can just do his thing. I don't mean carry like whatever, but just, you know, be okay. And Thornton, if he can kind of fit in up there, it does allow you to have this different kind of I don't know if you'd want to call it a shutdown line, but maybe you'd send it a little more often for defensive zone draws and things like that. I do wonder, just kind of staying on the Matthews line, do you worry, even though they are different types of setup guys, that it is too much of one thing on one line? And I can't believe I'm saying this, that it puts all the pressure on maybe the best shooter in the league to shoot too much. Like, would you not just put two guys on Matthews and know that those other two wingers are going to be hesitant to shoot, right? Like, I do wonder if it's not a little predictable at that point.
No, I don't think so. I think when you look at, the way that Marner looked in the last couple of days in camp, you can see that he wants to grow himself back into that player who can do a little bit of both. If anything, it's not so much putting pressure on Matthews, it's taking pressure off Marner to be that playmaker in that role. Because if you put those two together, you're making Marner think, oh God, I have to pass to Austin. Right. Why would I not? This way it can be, okay, I'm being passed to as well. We're making plays together. We can cycle. We can move. We can find opportunities. We can pull the puck closer to the net because all three of us are strong playmakers. We kind of forget this with Matthews because of how good his shot is, but he's a pretty damn good playmaker as well.
Yes.
He was very close to Thornton in terms of shot assist rate last season. Corey's data had him in the 94th percentile.
Wow.
Thankfully, I have all these charts next to me to kind of reference that I made a couple of weeks ago. I'm at this photographic when it comes to when it comes to this. But yeah, these are all guys who can move the thing, and it gives an opportunity for them to get into better scoring positions and shoot from areas where they might not have gotten those opportunities before. That means that you don't necessarily have to be a generational shooting talent like Matthews is to get a shot off if you're in a better location.
Right.
A great comparison for people who have followed the Leafs over the past several years is Tyler Bozak for a while was near the top in history and shooting percentage in a legitimate way, not even like he's good luck. It was like, no, you had Phil Kessel next to him who actually had a pretty decent eye for this stuff and was able to put him in front of the net and put in tap-ins. Alex Tanguay scored at like 20% for his entire career. And he's not a guy who's thought of as right. having a blazing shot. It just gets him into a better spot. And a guy like Thornton, he's a 13, 14% career shooter. And that's what an elite sniper shoots at, and it's not because he has an elite sniping talent. He's still very good. He's Joe Thornton, but it's because his shot selection brings him closer to the slot when he takes his opportunities. And when you have three guys who can think at this level and make plays at this level, maybe it gives them opportunities mm-hmm. to shoot from areas where they didn't have the chance to before.
Relatedly, it does look like that number one power play is going to be that top line of Matthews, Marner, and Thornton with Wayne Simmonds in front of the net and Morgan Rielly on the point. I think I can wrap my head around everything you're saying in terms of why this will work as a number one line. I do wish there was another shooter on that top power play. Again, you know, Simmonds is going to hopefully do his thing in front of the net. And I know Marner wants to shoot some more, but I wouldn't mind seeing somebody with a little more snap, right? A little more shot there on that number one power play. Clearly they're looking to split it up a bit. Tavares and Nylander down on the second one with Hyman in front of the net and Spezza. And it looks like to start TJ Brody. So if you were to take Tavares or Nylander off of that unit, it's not nearly as balanced at that point. I sort of see the split they're trying to go with, but do you think it should be a little different on the power play than it is with your standard lines, or are you comfortable with it there too?
I think it's really difficult to say right now. When you look at, you have to kind of look at the process of how Toronto gets power plays, and this is something I need to do some more research in. I need to kind of detail this down. I wonder how much thought was put into those units from the perspective of, okay, what players are usually on the ice when we draw them?
Okay.
How often do we expect to draw penalties this year? Do we want to put players that are likely going to be the ones who were on in the first place to be on the top unit right away, a little bit gassed? Mm-hmm. Just kind of spitballing here, like guys like Tavares and Nylander are the ones who are going to be harassed a little bit for the puck because they're so strong on it. Maybe they think that they're going to be drawing more penalties this year and they'll be best suited to kind of being that second unit. Or maybe they don't even really know yet if Toronto is going to get the same benefit or lack of benefit rather, as they've gotten in recent years where they've been near the bottom of the league and both penalties drawn and penalties taken,
mm-hmm.
Which sounds kind of neutral in the wash. But if you're a team that's strong on special teams, you almost kind of want to be high in both. You know that it's going to be basically even anyway, so why not lean into the chaos? This is a topic I've kind of talked about for years. Like Tampa's really good at this. Boston's really good at this, where they kind of force special teams to happen because they know that they can excel on it and drive goal differential in that way.
Right.
I think Toronto's kind of thinking that mindset now. It's one of the reasons they've tried to get a little bit grittier. I don't think it's so much in the fact that they think their players are scared. I think that's kind of stupid, but they understand that to not be on the ice 5-on-5 the entire time. They're going to have to create some sort of commotion in these games. Playing completely by the rules is not working. It just forces the entire game to be in that situation. And if you believe in your power play, which with four superstars, you should. Mm-hmm. And if you believe in your penalty kill, which with the right minds added and guys who are fast counterattackers, you also should. You want more of that to happen. And it's not as easy as just like going to Ilya Mikheyev and being like, hey, go slash him in the face. That's not going to work. It needs to kind of be natural, otherwise the refs aren't going to call it properly. So I wonder how much they kind of put into that.
We did see last year, right? You put all your eggs in one basket, and then not only if it didn't work, you know, where they spent, you had to go another shift or two with makeshift lines that had no chance of scoring because all your top guys were still resting from the power play. Like at this point, it kind of looks like they've just decided, well, let's just run with our lines, and then whoever, if PP2 finishes it, at least line one still fresh to go.
Right, exactly. Your post power play unit, which is something that Keith puts put a decent bit of thought in on the Marlies. I noticed a lot that he has assigned players to go right after the power play, right after the penalty kill. That's something that they have to consider too. You don't necessarily want it to just be your fourth line,
right?
Especially if it's a case where you may have had a good power play in terms of generating shots, but they just didn't go in. You want to kind of keep that momentum. Sure, you don't want the next shift to be a killer in that regard. There's so much game theory that kind of goes into the idea of special teams now that makes this whole thing pretty difficult. But at the end of the day, you still have capable players on both of these units. So I think this is going to be a starting point. But there's a lot of room for tinkering if they start noticing trends that might make it a little bit, might give another edge to them if they're able to adjust.
So you referenced a few minutes ago that Toronto is likely favored to win this division. That does seem to be the consensus. If they're not going to, who's going to be the team that takes it away from them? Kind of how do you see that top tier of this division shaking loose?
I wish I had an answer for you. I don't know. I don't think anyone who tells you they know with that bunch of the division is lying. Now, I mean, if you ask most of the mainstream media right now, it's Montreal, which is an observation that kind of confuses me.
Like I don't get it at all.
They had great shot differentials last year. That I'll give them that. But it seems like a lot of this is just Carey Price was good on the plains, so Carey Price is back to 2015.
Yeah. Nick Suzuki and Kotkaniemi were great for 9 games in August in the bubble. I assume they're now awesome forever.
It's so weird. I think people forget that Montreal was literally a day away from not playing in those plains.
Right.
Remember, the plains were expanded to allow for 24 teams, and they still, if we pulled the COVID rope a day later. And they had lost to Buffalo in the night that they canceled. Yeah. They wouldn't have even been in the playoffs,
right.
And the conversation kind of wouldn't have happened.
19 wins in 70 games or something. You're like,
all
right, like
right. And so they got that opportunity. They looked pretty good in that series against Pittsburgh. Though one can argue that Pittsburgh looked really bad in that series against themselves. It's so tough to gauge, and I feel like right now there's this kind of expectation for them, and then the reasoning is almost worked backwards. Like they started at the Habs are going to be better,
right?
Then they went to go find why. I remember when the I mentioned this point earlier. I remember when the Josh Anderson for Max Domi trade happened, and I'm like, I like this trade for Montreal, and people were like, really? And now today, Frank Saravalli puts out this poll of insiders from around the league,
right.
And they have that as the trade of the summer. And it's like, where was this energy when it happened? I feel like you've talked yourself into this, and you might even be right.
Yeah, sure.
Because I do like Josh Anderson, but I don't know where this suddenly became that. Nothing has changed between those two players to change that opinion. And then when you go and look at the cup predictions that they have, the bottom of that, Montreal is the third most represented team in the Stanley Cup Finals predictions behind Colorado and Tampa Bay. And I just don't get it. No. They could go on that run. They are,
of course.
Yeah.
You have a goalie that could. Who knows what they might do? And to me, it might be that simple. Which Carey Price are we getting this year? I do believe they're better than last year. but you're going to have to show me something, right? Like, you're going to have to play these games and show me that those two centers have arrived and that Josh Anderson is back to being Josh Anderson. Like, maybe, but let's see. Like,
exactly. And when you kind of go through all these Canadian teams, it's the same kind of questions you have. Like, the Vancouver Canucks lost a ton of players. Yes, they have Elias Pettersson, who is one of the most dazzling superstars in the league, and Quinn Hughes, who can literally win a Norris at any minute. I think the world of him, and I think he's going to be the best defenseman in the world soon. But is that enough?
Right.
Given what they had lost
a year ago, Canucks fans would be telling you that without our goalie Markstrom, like, we're nothing. He should be winning the Vezina. Now he left, and like, we're still awesome. Like, all right.
Yeah, and then the Flames are pretty much just the Canucks plus a couple of other players at this point, and I don't know how well that mixes. Monahan has had a rough season. Yeah. Gaudreau kind of disappointed. It's hard to say there. Edmonton is. Yeah, they have Connor McDavid, who's the best player in the world, no question still. And Leon Draisaitl had an incredible year. But can Mikko Koskinen still be strong in net again? Does their defense click? Winnipeg, do they have defensemen? This is a very weird thing. And then someone had mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago, and I agree with them. Winnipeg's defense is what people think the Leafs defense is,
right?
In the sense that, like, I don't know if anyone on it is legitimately, you can say they are definitely good. They are the team that should probably be trading a forward for a defenseman,
right?
When you really think of it, because they have guys who, even like Patrick Laine, who are looking to move, and then you go and look through their D and it's like
Trouba back.
Yeah, it's like Josh Morrissey might be good.
Yeah,
and they paid a lot to find out. Right. We'll have to see. Neil Pionk, analytics people like him, but he doesn't really face the tough competition. He might just be a guy. Mm-hmm. Dylan DeMello, same story. He might just be a guy. When I say guy, I'm talking the tiers of, like, for the Toronto example, Travis Dermott, Justin Hall.
Right.
Sort of, yeah, they're good, but are they good because of their environment? I think Hall has actually kind of graduated himself out of that with his last year, but that's where you would have perceived him a year ago. Their team is kind of littered with those, and then it drops off even further beyond that, players who are just flat out bad, which makes it really all the more surprising that someone claimed Lucas Bisa today because he couldn't make that team. But that's neither here or there. But it kind of goes through the same thing. You go through all these teams and there's a lot of questions. And don't get me wrong, Toronto has its questions too, because there have been wholesale changes over the season. But at the same time, they have that steady nucleus of top talent. They have a group of high-end forwards, high-end defensemen, and a high-end, hopefully, goaltender in Frederik Andersen. That's that gives a little bit more security there. So as to who I think could take it away, it could be any of them. I don't know if there's a clear favorite there. If I had to guess, it'd probably be a Montreal or a Calgary.
I got Calgary up there. That's where
I'm. Yeah, just because they have enough good tier players.
Nice, well-rounded and good goaltending.
Yeah, they are less screwed if they have a major injury happen. Yeah. Like, if the Canucks lose Pettersson early in the season, they're going to be worse than the Senators.
Yeah.
Like, they might be at Detroit tier.
Wow.
This is kind of the issue that a couple of these teams have, is they're like one or two injuries away from being on a tailspin.
Well, I wonder if you agree. I've kind of got, even Winnipeg with the questionable defense, I think when we start, this is going to be super sloppy. It's been very limited camps and no preseason games. So give me, for the first couple weeks, your Edmontons and your Winnipegs, whose defense might be questionable but has a ton of talent to capitalize on what's going to be sloppy across the league. And at the end of the season, those points will still count. And that's sort of, you know, why I've got them up maybe as high as I do.
That's a fair point. There's going to be so much variance at the start of the year. It's going to be a total crapshoot. Even a team like an Ottawa can keep themselves from staying at the bottom just by banking at the start of the year if they come out hungry and coordinated.
Yeah.
And that's the quote unquote beauty of a 56 game schedule is anything could happen. We can attest to that in this city with the 2013 Maple Leafs, who, by God, they were not good, but they found a way to use those 48 games to get themselves in.
Last thing for you then before we get out of here. Maybe it's in the Canadian division, maybe it's not, whether it's a player or a storyline or something across these 56 games that maybe is out of the ordinary, or in a normal season you wouldn't be looking for, but this year you're like, I think this could be interesting, or these guys could surprise in a short season. Just kind of a storyline you're going to be following.
There's so many around the league right now. If I'm thinking an individual player, I really want to see what Devin Toews does in Colorado. Yeah. Obviously the Islanders moved him, due to their cap struggles, which GM I still don't know how to, man. Leo Komarov's on waivers today, by the way. Two more years of $3 million. God bless Leo, but who could have seen that coming? Yeah, like I've thought the world of Toews for years. He was a standout with the Bridgeport Sound Tigers. I thought it took them almost too much time to get him up to the Islanders. And there were a few people who looked him in the bubble and said that he wasn't that great. But again, so hard to judge off of a couple of weeks sample size. He's incredibly mobile. He's very smart. And they're starting him with Cale Makar. So there
not
is
not bad.
Yeah, he's gonna get great minutes with a contract already locked up. There's no reason to kind of shelter him at this point. And a contract that any team should have been pretty happy to have. I would have been happy to sign him at that $4 million cap hit that they got him for. And just the Avs in general are going to be a fun team. A lot of people have them as the favorite to win it all. It's so hard to pick a favorite this year, but the very least they're going to be really exciting. But I think just the excitement of all this is just not really knowing where it's going to go. You have to face teams so many times.
Yes.
And
it's like the original six times four, right? Like
exactly.
You're going to run this four times. It's going to be awesome. Like,
right. There, every game is going to have significant standings implication. And you can't just kind of commit to one play style. It's going to be constant game theory against teams that you're familiar with, because you will always have the book on your opponent. There will be constant switch ups, and I think we're going to learn a lot about the players who can adapt quickly, which I think is one of the most valuable assets in this game, is how quick you can think plays through.
Right.
That's going to be put heavily on display this year. Health is obviously going to be a big factor too, but seeing teams adjust and adapt is going to be the main storyline of this season. And it might lead to teams that we don't expect to succeeding on the backs of players who do it well, or coaches who adjust well or know how to match up against opponents. It's going to be a very different National Hockey League this year than we've seen in a very long time. And it's almost like six
playoff series going on at once, right? Like if you face the Bruins in the first round for seven games, they happen seven in a row. But by the end of it, like you have studied their power play and their penalty kill and you know where to attack. You're going to play the Canucks nine times this year and you're going to play they're going to be intermittent and split out, but those coaching staffs by the end of it, they'll be all over you, right? Like everybody's going to know everybody pretty well.
Right. It's going to be a great litmus test for a lot of people, from the players to the staff to even the media and the fans covering them. I think we're going to have a greater understanding of how to pick apart this league, because it's just such a great, it's almost like a lab experiment this year. I can't wait for it.
I know I said that was the last one. I guess I lied because I forgot. I did want to ask you, by the end of the season, do you believe Nick Robertson has become a regular for the Leafs this year?
Yes. I think he starts. I don't know if he starts with the Leafs full on. I think it's impressive that he got to stick around as long as he did. But the fact that he has that AHL flexibility is going to work to his favor. My guess is what they'll probably do is taxi squad him for the first couple weeks. And once the AHL season gets closer, they'll send him down. I think that's a great opportunity for them that they normally would not have due to the CHL transfer agreement. He'll get to play with most likely Joey Anderson, who's trying to build himself into a Zach Hyman type player, and either Engvall if he's still down there, or Adam Brooks if they switch them around. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a very, very good top line. He'll get to play power play, penalty kill. It's going to adapt him into a player that's going to be a very valuable piece of this organization. When you look at what he's done at his age, it's incredibly impressive. People forget. I don't want to say people forget, but he was the youngest player in his draft class. He was very close to not being eligible the year that the Leafs took him. And if they would have had to have waited till this year, he would have been much more than the second round pick than he was. Like he would have probably been top 10 consideration. So the Leafs really hit a home run there. I think it's likely that he plays himself into the lineup, especially just when you look at the way that he's able to release the puck. Like he's going to be an elite finisher. I know it's a limited,
you know, a small sample size, all that stuff. But even that one shot in that in the scrimmage, you're just like, okay, I see what we're waiting on or what we're doing here, right?
Like, yeah, that was the exclamation point statement to everyone who's casually followed, to be like, this is what this kid's going to be eventually.
Right.
It's insane what he can do with a puck.
Tell us where we can find your work. Tell us about the faceoffcircle.ca.
You can find my work at that very space, faceoffcircle.ca. It's been more of a tinkering space over the past couple of years, but this year I'm looking more towards publishing Leafs and Marlies coverage on a daily or near daily basis. Just kind of breaking down the game from an analytical side, an eyeball side, kind of reading the tea leaves, that sort of thing. Just trying to give a different perspective than what you're grabbing from everybody else. So hopefully you follow along, maybe get a membership if you feel like supporting the site in a financial way. If not, that's okay too. It's just going to be a fun year, and we're going to have a lot of fun hockey talk.
I've had a membership. I'm a day one guy. I can highly recommend. It's worth following. Jeff's also on Twitter at Jeff Vallette. We will share all these links in the show notes at tallcanaudio.com. And don't forget, on Thursday morning, if you're looking for the other side of this coin as far as the Battle of Ontario goes, Graham Nichols from the Sixth Sens will be here, and he will kind of break down the Senators for us. But
he's great, and
he does some really cool work. He's been on a time or two before as well, so we're looking forward to that. Jeff, thank you so much for doing this, man. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
And hopefully we can touch base down the road a little bit once we have some games behind us and see how all this looks then. Until then, we are on Twitter and Instagram at TallCanAudio, Facebook.com/TallCanAudio. We will catch you all next time.
It is over!
Now that's a tasty beverage.
Thanks for listening. You can get more TCA at TallCanAudio.com or by searching TallCanAudio on your favorite podcast app.